Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
He would appear in the dark.
Handing, literally handing.
He was a killer.
World of Secrets, Season 3, The Apartheid Killer. Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 10th of July, these are our main stories. Israel's told all residents of Gaza City to evacuate. It'll be the second time they've had to leave the biggest city in the territory. Meanwhile, indirect talks on the conflict are resuming in Qatar. NATO leaders continue their summit in Washington, with the defence of Ukraine again at the top of the agenda. And the trial begins in Australia of 14 members of a religious sect accused of denying medication to a diabetic 8-year-old who then died. Also in this podcast, Joe Biden's fended off mounting calls to step down as the Democrat nominee.
Joe Biden has indicated he is going to run, and I'm glad he is. He's going to continue to run. He and Vice President Harris can beat Donald Trump, and they'll do it again.
And another joke from the Simpsons TV show is coming true. The Israeli military dropped leaflets over Gaza City on Wednesday, telling all residents to evacuate and head towards the centre of the territory. It's the second time people have been told to flee the city since the start of the conflict. The leaflets warn that the city's about to become a dangerous combat zone and give instructions on safe evacuation routes. Airstrikes continue in southern Gaza. These women and children were among those sheltering at a school in Khan Yunis before it was hit by an airstrike on Tuesday, killing at least 29 people.
We were just sitting. Nothing was going on. Everything was normal. There was no sounds of planes or anything. There were a group of women and men sat over there. And suddenly a rocket fell. There were injuries and deaths.
They were sitting there looking at their phones, and suddenly they were hit with no warning or anything. We found them scattered all over the place. We've been destroyed. There is no more life.
Israel says that strike was targeted at a member of Hamas who took part in the October the 7th attacks. The Israeli Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant, says their aim to eliminate Hamas is well underway.
We've eliminated or wounded 60% of the Hamas terrorists. We've disbanded 24 battalions, or the vast majority of them. We've returned half of the hostages, and we are determined to retrieve the rest. And all of us, the security establishment and myself heading it, are determined to achieve the goals of the war and complete them.
All of this comes as indirect talks on a ceasefire take place in Qatar. Our correspondent Nick Beek is in Jerusalem and told us about this latest evacuation order.
We know that this is something the Israeli army has used in the course of the past 9 months to signal that an operation is either imminent or will be coming in the days and weeks to come. And we've been in touch with people in Gaza City itself today, and they've confirmed that they've received these messages, these letters that have been dropped from the sky. And just looking at what's said on it, it's addressed to all the residents of Gaza City, so everyone it would seem, and the message is that there are safe corridors, according to the Israelis, where people can leave Gaza City. They won't be checked, and there are a number of places they're told to go to. There's also streets marked where people are told they'll receive safe passage. And the final message is that Gaza City remains a dangerous fighting zone. So the Israelis saying today that Palestinians in Gaza City should leave. Of course, the criticism will be, and it has been over the course of the past 9 months, that these sort of evacuation zones and routes are not safe. And there are numerous accusations levelled at the Israelis that people have been killed or seriously injured trying to make this perilous journey from one place where they've been told to leave.
And meanwhile, ceasefire talks are getting underway in Qatar.
Yes, that's right. They resumed today in Qatar. You've got the spy chiefs from America, from Israel, Egypt also meeting the Qatari Prime Minister. And the hope is that this is moving towards some sort of ceasefire in Gaza with the release of some of the hostages taken on October the 7th by Hamas. No indication of how the talks are going so far. The BBC has got confirmation that they have resumed. The White House has indicated it's cautiously optimistic that some of the gaps can be closed, but no sign of any sort of imminent breakthrough at the moment.
That was Nick Beek in Jerusalem. It's day two of the three-day NATO conference in Washington, D.C., marking 75 years since the military alliance was formed. Addressing world leaders, President Biden described the grouping as the greatest defence alliance in the world, and he used his address to promise five more air defence systems for Ukraine. Our North America correspondent Tom Bateman listened to the speech.
Reaching the stage with an orchestral introduction in the same hall where NATO's founding treaty was signed in 1949, Mr. Biden vowed resolve in Europe's modern war, saying Ukraine would win against Russia. He pledged more air defence equipment for the country and took credit for NATO's expansion and increased defence spending. The alliance, he said, was now stronger than ever, but that wasn't guaranteed.
This is a pivotal moment for Europe, for the transatlantic community, and I might add for the world. The fact that NATO remains the bulwark of global security did not happen by accident. It wasn't inevitable. Again and again at critical moments, we chose unity over disunion, freedom over tyranny, hope over fear. Again and again, we stood behind our shared vision of a peaceful and prosperous transatlantic community.
Mr. Biden invoked the memory of Ronald Reagan, a clear message meant to appeal to Republicans and expose the dangers, as he sees them, posed by Donald Trump, who has brought NATO skeptic messages back to the election campaign trail.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is at the summit. He made clear he hoped that there'd be a clear timetable for Ukraine to join the military alliance. He also urged allies to go further and provide Ukraine more aircraft, including F-16s. Our Ukraine correspondent is James Waterhouse.
President Zelensky, with the events in Kyiv, notably this week with these devastating Russian missile strikes, had been calling for 10 American-made Patriot air defence systems. They're incredibly sophisticated pieces of weaponry which are capable of intercepting hypersonic Russian missiles. Now, five have been announced by President Biden. We've also had a statement saying that Ukraine's membership to NATO is irreversible, but I think these kind of agreements and statements are the best President Zelensky can hope for as long as Russia continues to invade his country. In President Zelensky's ideal world, Ukraine would be announced as the 33rd member of NATO, Article 5 would be enacted, collective defence, and NATO would send soldiers to Ukraine and fend off the Russians. Now, of course, that's not going to happen, not least because the West is still incredibly anxious of the war in Ukraine turning into a world war. So this is kind of the next best thing. But I think the language of the Ukrainian Foreign Minister, Dmytro Kuleba, is interesting, where he is talking about seeking assurances and weaponry from the US as opposed to the NATO alliance itself. These kind of things are important politically for Ukraine in its continued war effort. But I think there is a bit of private frustration, and I think there is a degree of expectation, limited expectation, on the Kyiv side, certainly.
Now, obviously, there's still shock over the attack on a children's hospital in Kyiv on Monday. What's going on with the rescue effort?
I think now that, you know, the operation has gone from rescue to recovery. We were there yesterday, and we were meeting some of the patients who've been relocated to other hospitals. And the sheer horror they describe, you know, we met a 16-year-old girl who was receiving dialysis. She was already wheelchair-bound before the strike. She couldn't get to the air raid shelter with her mother in the basement. And her mother emerged to find a huge gaping hole in the building with smoke billowing out. And she didn't know where her daughter was. She could see bodies around. She feared the worst. They were eventually reunited, but it was a searing snapshot into the horror felt by those patients on that sunny morning. And I think these are sort of these emotive illustrations of how this invasion doesn't tend to discriminate when it comes to missiles falling from the sky.
That was James Waterhouse in Kyiv. To Australia now, where members of a religious sect have gone on trial, accused of denying medication to a diabetic 8-year-old who then died. The 14 members of the group known as the Saints allegedly prayed to God to cure Elizabeth Strew's type 1 diabetes rather than allowing her to receive insulin. She died in January 2022. Due to the complexity of the case, the trial will be conducted by a judge without a jury. Simon Atkinson spoke to us from outside the courthouse in Brisbane.
The 14 defendants are all members of a religious group that was based in the town of Toowoomba, which is about 125 kilometres west of Brisbane here in Queensland. A very small group, they called themselves the Saints. They had formed as a kind of a splinter group from another church a few years ago. Two of the defendants have been charged with murder. They include the father of Elizabeth Strews, Jason Strews, and also the leader of the religious group, Brendan Stevens. They're both charged with murder. Charged with manslaughter are Elizabeth Strews's mother, Curry, and her brother, Zachary, and 10 others aged between 22 and 67, all members of the church. They too are accused of manslaughter. They came into court today. They were quite smiley. They were joking with one another. They certainly didn't seem to be displaying any signs of tension. There was smiles to some of their supporters in the public gallery as well. They all opted not to enter any plea, which the court then entered as a not guilty plea. They're all representing themselves. They haven't got a lawyer who's presented what their argument is going to be as yet. All we've heard so far in the case is an outline of the prosecution.
What does the prosecution say?
Well, what we've heard from the prosecution is that Elizabeth Strews was an 8-year-old girl with diabetes, and the allegation is that she'd been denied her insulin for several days, that she'd eventually been unconscious and had been left to die. And what the prosecutors say is that the extreme beliefs of this religious group, they didn't believe that medicine worked, they didn't believe in the use of doctors, they thought that God would heal their daughter. So they left Elizabeth and she died a few days after the insulin was withdrawn. What we also learned from the prosecutors is that we will hear evidence that in 2019, Elizabeth was taken to hospital in a very serious condition, again, having been denied insulin. In that case, her mother was prosecuted and convicted of neglect. And so what the prosecution is trying to set out is this was a habitual behaviour and that the parents knew that the impact of taking away the insulin from their daughter was that it would severely damage her health and ultimately that she would die.
Simon Atkinson in Brisbane. It would be pretty disconcerting to find that any hygiene product contained toxic metals, but there's been particular alarm at the discovery that tampons have traces of lead, mercury, arsenic and other potentially dangerous substances. The research led by scientists in California and New York looked at more than a dozen tampon brands. Stephanie Zacharyson reports.
The study tested 30 types of tampons from 14 different brands, all widely available in the US, UK or the EU. The researchers chose 16 metals to check whether the tampons contained any of them.
The findings were in 100% of the samples, so this shows a systematic problem.
Dr. Marianti-Anna Chiomocciolo is a co-author of the report and associate professor at Columbia University. The team found several toxic metals, some in significant concentrations, such as cadmium, lead and arsenic. Some of those discoveries are particularly concerning. If lead leaches into the body, it can deposit itself in bones, staying in the body for a long time. Even low levels of lead are known to have a toxic impact on neurological health and behaviour, as well as on reproductive and cardiovascular health. Now, you might think that a product that is used inside the body would have been checked for potentially toxic substances, but Dr. Chiomocciolo says that is not the case.
We all assume they are safe. However, they have not been tested. We have really no idea. And this is the first step. And I think this is what it is a cry for more testing for these products that we use daily.
More research is needed, but even that has been hard. Dr. Chiomocciolo says it took her 10 years to get the funding for this study. Now they're looking at whether the metals in the tampons are released when they're used and absorbed by the body. Because when we consume toxins through food or drink, our liver normally takes care of getting rid of them. But when they enter through a tampon, they bypass the liver and could potentially go straight into the bloodstream.
menstruating people menstruate, you know, once a month, and some people wear up to 5, maybe 6 tampons a day, depending on their flow. But we do not yet have any of these answers.
For now, Dr. Kia Mocholo has taken a decision herself to use other alternatives.
I stopped wearing tampons and I'm wearing a menstrual cup.
Another question is how the metals have made their way into the product. Most tampons contain cotton, which could have absorbed substances from water or soil, or it could be explained by the production process. What the researchers are calling for is that there should be more regulations and transparency around what's in products that are used by millions of people on a regular basis.
That report by Stephanie Zacherson. Still to come.
It's just going to be so epic. When you think that this was sort of predicted in the 90s, it's really incredible to think it's actually happening.
28 years on, another joke from The Simpsons is coming true.
He was a kind of vigilante killer.
He killed at least 19 people during the 1980s in South Africa.
Very dark times.
People were desperate. We were looking for him. We couldn't find him. And nobody knew where he was.
Every single one of his victims was black.
He reached such a stage where he was now hunting.
World of Secrets from the BBC World Service. Season 3, The Apartheid Killer. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
In Sudan's civil war, the city of Al-Fashir remains an important prize. It's the Sudanese military's last foothold in the western region of Darfur, and it's in the grip of a punishing battle between the army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. A local cameraman, Mohammed Zakaria, has been sending the BBC footage from the besieged city. But at the beginning of June, he decided it was too dangerous to stay. This is the story about his journey out of the country through RSF-held territory, as told to Barbara Pletasha.
Mohammed's family had left weeks earlier. He stayed behind to work. But that was becoming impossible. It was risky to stay, but also risky to leave. Still, he decided to flee to South Sudan. First, Mohammed got on a donkey cart in a nearby refugee camp to leave his camera equipment with a friend there. But he took with him precious records of photographs and videos stored on memory cards and external hard drives.
The big problem I faced in the road, how I can hide these things, because this is a dangerous thing. If RSF or any soldier see it, you can't explain.
Mohammed entered territory held by the Rapid Support Forces shortly after leaving the refugee camp. He joined a convoy of other travelers. The danger was getting picked up by the RSF.
We paid to the RSF soldiers to go with us because the road is very dangerous. If you need to arrive safely, you need to pay to RSF.
He hid his memory cards in a piece of paper that he put with other documents. He'd also wiped his phone clear, getting rid of evidence that he'd been covering the war in Al-Fashir.
But the one I forget it, my Facebook account.
The account had posts like this. Footage of children in Al-Fashir hospital and of the bombing. An RSF soldier discovered it at a checkpoint in the city of El Dain.
I say I am a spy and I am working against the RSF.
Mohammed was detained and interrogated. He said he was threatened with torture and death unless he disclosed the information he was accused of hiding.
So how did you feel, Mo, during this time? I mean, you were with him for what, 4 or 5 hours?
I feel lost. I don't believe now I am here. You feel like you are in a very bad situation. If he want to kill you, no one will know.
This was the scariest part of the trip. Mohammed managed to buy his freedom with a large sum of money. He was now very anxious to get to South Sudan as quickly as possible. Instead, there was this. Mohammed had squeezed onto the roof of a pickup truck crowded with other travelers. But they got stuck in a forest because of heavy rains, then delayed by engine trouble and fuel shortages for 5 days.
The first day, we don't have problem because we have a little food with us. And the next 2 days, just dates and water. Water from the rain, from the ground. We drink the water from the ground.
At last, they made it to the town just before the border, El Regabat. But then someone reported them, said they were from a tribe that fights with the army against the RSF.
The next day in the morning, RSF come to us to take all of us to the office.
There were more interrogations and one final payment for safe passage. Finally, Mohammed crossed into South Sudan.
I feel I'm alive. I really don't believe that I'm alive. I'm here and I made it. I reached to South Sudan with all my data and with all my laptop, my externals. And I crossed with much of RSF. Really.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, unbelievable, yeah.
Sudanese photojournalist Mohammed Zakaria speaking to our Africa correspondent Barbara Plettusher. President Biden's re-election campaign has been on increasingly shaky ground since his stumbling debate performance against Donald Trump a week and a half ago. He, however, insists he's in good shape and has no intention of pulling out of the race. Following several meetings on Tuesday, top Democrats in Congress indicated that they were unwilling to withdraw their support, at least for now. One of them backing Mr. Biden to stay the course is Congresswoman Barbara Lee of California.
You can't sugarcoat the debate. It was a horrible debate, and everyone knows that, and the president has admitted that. But that does not mean that he has not been a good president, he's a global leader, and that he is not up for the job. He is. He's campaigning all across the country. He knows the world in which we live. He has integrity. He's fighting. He's honest. And I think that people will look at the differences between a Joe Biden, because Joe Biden has indicated he is going to run, and I'm glad he is. He's going to continue to run and see the contrast between him and Donald Trump. Do they want 4 years of a convicted felon or not? And Joe Biden has proven that he and Vice President Harris can beat Donald Trump, and they'll do it again.
P.J. Crowley is the former deputy press secretary under President Clinton, and he says the president's future is far from certain.
Every president has a crisis, and obviously in President Clinton's case, it was Monica Lewinsky. And there the press overplayed its hand. The Republicans on the Hill, through impeachment, overplayed their hand. President Clinton's not only recovered his approval rating. At the end of 2000, he was more popular than he was when he won his second term. But President Clinton had, you know, he had a way with words, right? And I mean, that is a challenge for Joe Biden. He's older, less articulate, and that's going to be his challenge between now and November.
But who could replace Mr. Biden if he were to step aside? Katrina Perry of the Global Story podcast has been speaking to the BBC US special correspondent, Katty Kay.
It's always been something of a mystery to me, the degree to which Kamala Harris is really sort of hated by some on the right of American politics. I wonder why, because really she hasn't done very much. I mean, vice presidents are sort of fairly powerless, innocuous figures, and I would say that has been pretty much true of Kamala Harris. So it's sort of hard to totally understand unless there's an element of her being a woman, a non-white candidate. All of those things are raised by supporters of Kamala Harris to explain why she hasn't been popular. Since the debate, there's been one or two polls suggesting that actually she would outperform Joe Biden up against Donald Trump. Who knows whether that's true or not?
Katty, if it's not Kamala Harris, then a few other names have been knocking around in recent days. Obviously, California Governor Gavin Newsom, I think the self-declared available candidate there. And also the Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Can you tell us a little bit about those two?
She is routinely named in the last few days as the person that Democrats feel would have the best chance of beating Donald Trump. She's a fairly centrist, articulate on television. She prosecutes the case against Donald Trump forcefully. Gavin Newsom, although he has been out around the country for a while, raising his own profile in big television interviews and big events, and clearly would like to be president of the United States one day and makes no bones about that. He is not somebody that is named for 2024 in this cycle. I think that's because the sort of whole California Democrat thing is seen as too unappealing to centrist voters in Rust Belt states. And they don't think that a California Democrat is what they need. They feel they need a Midwesterner, which Gretchen Whitmer is.
Katie, a quick word on Michelle Obama, whose name is also being rolled around.
the kind of myth that won't go. No, it's not happening. Michelle Obama has made it very clear that she has absolutely zero interest in returning to the White House in any capacity. 8 years there as First Lady was quite enough for her. I think Democrats have to give up on that fantasy fast.
Katie Kay speaking to Katrina Perry there. And if you want to hear more of that discussion, you can listen to The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts. Now, you know those big royal events in the UK when the royal family wave from the balcony at Buckingham Palace to the crowds below? Well, now the public can visit the room they emerge from and other areas of the palace's east wing. Our culture correspondent Charlotte Gallagher has been for a preview.
From jubilees, coronations and marriages, the Buckingham Palace balcony has seen generations of the royal family step out and wave to the crowds. Now visitors will be able to look through the balcony doors and down the mall, though they won't actually be allowed out onto it. Other parts of the East Wing people will be able to visit include the yellow drawing room with towering porcelain pagodas and detailed wallpaper, which was recently taken down and painstakingly restored before being placed back. The public will also be able to walk down the principal corridor, which is filled with priceless art, and see Jonathan Yeo's new painting of the King.
Charlotte Gallagher, always oddly comfortable in a palace. The Simpsons has a remarkable record of predicting the future. There was a mention of President Trump 16 years before it happened. Then Homer Simpson won a Winter Olympics curling gold medal, beating Sweden in the final, 8 years before the US's first ever curling gold medal, where they beat Sweden in the final. On Wednesday, another Simpsons joke, this one made 28 years ago, will become a reality. American hip-hop trio Cypress Hill will perform a concert at the Royal Albert Hall, accompanied by the London Symphony Orchestra. Here's our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson.
This is the sound of the 90s hip-hop act Cypress Hill rehearsing with the London Symphony Orchestra, a collaboration almost 30 years in the making.
Come on, people, somebody order the London Symphony Orchestra, possibly while high. Cypress Hill, I'm looking in your direction.
It was back in 1996 when an episode of The Simpsons called Homerpalooza featured a joke where Cypress Hill believed they had mistakenly booked the LSO whilst under the influence.
Oh yeah, we think we did.
Tonight, that joke becomes a reality.
Hits from the bong.
At the Royal Albert Hall. Be Real is one of Cypress Hill's founding members.
It's been something that we've talked about for many years since the Simpsons episode first aired. The what if, like, what if we actually did that?
How did it come about?
It didn't actually start to come to life till a tweet happened.
In 2017, the band reminded people about the episode on their social media, and the London Symphony Orchestra replied, quoting some of the dialogue.
We mostly know classical, but we could give it a shot.
Cypress Hill were the first rap group to be given a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and tonight's show will feature their Black Sunday album being played in its entirety. It sold more than 3 million copies in the US and spent a whole year on the UK charts. Maxine Kwok is the London Symphony Orchestra's first violin.
It's just going to be so epic. When you think that this was sort of predicted in the 90s, it's really incredible to think it's actually happening.
It's such an unlikely story, this.
I know. It really is. But it actually fits together incredibly well, and it's so exciting for us.
Is this the sweariest gig in the LSO history?
Yes, I think potentially it is.
There have, however, been some moments of cultural confusion. I was told that when the words Glock had been used during rehearsals as an abbreviation for the percussive instrument Glockenspiel, Cypress Hill were taken aback. To them, a Glock will always be a gun. Should I put the Glock there? The punchline of the Homerpalooza episode was that the London Symphony Orchestra had actually been booked by the English soft rocker Peter Frampton, best known for his album Frampton Comes Alive.
Is he on the guest list?
Yeah, he is, actually. We've been trying to invite him.
No.
Yeah. I mean, we've never met him before, but we thought it would be a kick to, like, invite the legendary Peter Frampton, you know?
Is he going to come?
We don't know. We're still waiting.
And as for Cypress Hill, they really feel tonight's show has been their destiny.
We salute the Simpsons, man, because if they had not written that episode, we probably wouldn't be doing this.
That report from Colin Patterson with Cypress Hill. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, just send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Sydney Dundon. The producer was Ella Bicknell. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
A $6 billion con.
It didn't take long for it to spread like wildfire.
You got to take a look at this really crazy gold stock. A buddy of mine got in at a dime.
Which destroyed lives and devastated communities.
Every little town across the nation, people have shares in this.
We lost everything.
And to date, no one has been brought to justice.
Somebody knows more than we know.
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC. All episodes are available now. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.